Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Before I start, I do want to commend the UC Berkeley School of Law for hosting this event and getting us all together and providing this forum for the exchange of valuable information on such a number of interesting subjects. When I had the opportunity to moderate this particular panel, I jumped at the opportunity because when I was in private law practice, family law was an area that I enjoyed practicing in and was, at the end of my practice, a large part of my caseload. So it is a subject near and dear to my heart, and I always look forward to weighing in on family law cases that come before our court. I'd like to briefly introduce the panelists at this time and later give a more thorough introduction as they make their presentations. Bonnie Huff, Justice Lori Zelon, Sue Talia, and our commentator, Professor Richard Banks. The topic that we're going to address is access to justice in family court. I can recall as a practitioner in the area of family law that the family law bar was often very critical of the court for not providing access to justice. One of the common problems we encountered was the most recent judge appointed to the Superior Court would automatically be given the toughest assignment, which was family law, where not only would that judge be faced with new legal issues, but he would also be faced with these emotional issues that come with the territory. And during my tenure as appointment secretary, I would often complain to presiding judges that this simply isn't fair and that the more experienced judges should rightfully be appointed to handle the family law court. I think there's been a change in attitude, at least I hope there has been, over time. And I know that over time, a number of practitioners with expertise in the area of family law have made their way to the Superior Court, and some have chosen to stay in family law department and to provide the access to justice that the clients deserve. The challenge is to provide access to the high number of self-represented litigants in family law cases, particularly in dissolution and child support and custody matters. And this interest has really been fueled, I think, in large part by the recent decision authored by the Chief, Elkins versus Superior Court. The way we'll proceed is a little different than some of the other panels. Each panelist and our commentator will speak for approximately 15 minutes. There may or may not be some questions asked during that period of time, but there will be 20 minutes of questions and answers that will take place among the final panelists and the commentator and the audience. So I encourage you to write down questions during the course of the presentations and have them brought forward so that we can tackle those at the end of the session. The first panelist is Bonnie Huff, who's the managing attorney for the Center of Families, Children and the Courts at the administrative office of the courts. She's been there since 1997. She serves as committee counsel to the Judicial Council's Task Force on Self-Represented Litigants and also is staff to the Elkins Family Law Task Force. Her unit coordinates the California Courts Self-Help website. And if you don't have that website, let me give it to you because it contains a wealth of information. www.courtinfo.ca.gov/self-help. And it provides over 900 pages of legal and procedural information and referrals and has been translated into Spanish. She also oversees grant funds for court-based self-help centers and legal services programs and works to develop educational material for judges and court staff to assist them in handling cases with self-represented litigants. She also assists the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee of the Judicial Council in drafting family law rules and forms. In short, she is a wealth of information in this area. So, Bonnie, if you would proceed.
Thank you so much, Justice Baxter, and thank all of you for being here at this hour. I'm thrilled and delighted because I think family law is incredibly important, and I'm delighted that it's being covered in this workshop. Family law is just an incredibly important area. It deals with fundamental issues for the citizens of our society, including children, support, division of property. Probably any day in a family court, you'll see issues of tremendous value, pensions, houses, businesses being divided. And unfortunately, all too often, they don't receive the same amount of time as a similar type of case would in civil law. And I think we're still seeing some of the same issues, unfortunately, that you saw, Justice Baxter, in terms of family law attorneys often not being appointed to the bench, and that it's not always considered the most desirable assignment. So it is our work and our job to work on that. And I'm sorry, also an incredibly important issue that really has developed in the last 20 years is also protection from domestic violence, which is another really key factor that the family courts have to consider and respond to. And as the U.S. Supreme Court pointed out in the Bodie case, the superior courts really have sort of a monopoly on the issue of divorce. If you're dissolving your partnership or working out some sort of business civil problem, you can walk away, you can choose to do a mediation or whatever, never appearing in front of the court. In a divorce case, the only way to get divorced is to go through a court process, which is an open process. You're divulging a fair amount of information, and it just, you know, so if 50% of the folks in California are getting a divorce, most of those people are seeing courthouses. But not only do you have to go to court to get a divorce, you have no right to counsel, you have no right to an interpreter, and frankly, you have no right to a court-paid court reporter. So you are in a situation where you have to do this process, but you're not necessarily getting a lot of help to do it. In a recent study, average attorney fees for family law practitioners in California was about $350 an hour. That's over a week's worth of work for a minimum wage worker, even if all their gross income was able to go to pay for that. Legal aid in California, unfortunately, has been tremendously underfunded for many years, and so they have generally chosen to make family law a low priority because it generally is responding to low-income people in a struggle together. So we've had very little representation in family law. They've been doing more with domestic violence, but still are often not in a situation where people can come to court. So what does this mean? As of 2004 in California, 67% of petitioners in family law cases were pro per at the time of filing, and 72% in the larger jurisdictions. And interestingly, at the time that their divorce was finalized, 80% of them were self-represented. Now, I used to think, well, you'd start out doing it yourself because you didn't really realize it was so complicated, and then you'd sort of get it that you really had to hire a lawyer. Well, in fact, that isn't the case. And in fact, probably many people start with a lawyer and wind up running out of money and being in a difficult position to finish that case. And we are also deeply concerned that there are a lot of people out there who are, in fact, not finishing their case because they just don't know how to do it. Many of them think they have, and maybe move on with their lives and become accidental bigamists. Not a great situation. In child support cases, both parties are unrepresented 63% of the time, and one party is unrepresented 21% of the time, which means that in 84% of those child support cases, at least one of the parties is unrepresented. In domestic violence, it looks like about 90% of the litigants are unrepresented. In San Diego, divorce filings involving at least one self-represented litigant rose from 46% in 1992 to 77% in 2000. But this is not just a California trend. This is really national in scope. In Utah, where Justice Durham is from, 49% of petitioners and 81% of respondents in divorce cases were unrepresented. In Wisconsin, 70% of family law cases involved a self-represented litigant. In New Hampshire, 70% of dissolutions involve one self-represented litigant, and 97% of domestic violence cases involve self-represented litigants. In Phoenix, Arizona, over 90% of divorces involved a self-represented litigant. In Florida, 73% of hearings involved at least one self-represented litigant in family law. And in Boston, over 75% of family law cases involve one self-represented litigant. It's a national problem. It's a national issue. And given the fact that we constructed our court system assuming that we would have two attorneys who would be representing people's needs and interests, it's something that the court system absolutely have to look at, has to respond to. What does it mean? Well, all too often, I think we're concerned that it means that people are not able to adequately get their issues resolved. They're not able to understand what the legal issues are and to make sure that their rights in pension plans and houses and support and other kinds of issues are adequately taken care of. We have this accidental bigamy problem. In fact, for many years, we have not had any kind of case management in family law. It's a civil procedure, and on the civil side, there's a whole kind of time frame and structure for making sure that the case moves along. In family law, I think there's been a lot of concern that we don't want to force people into divorce. I mean, we certainly don't want to, you know, say, oh, gosh, you filed your case, you really have to get divorced now. But what we found is because we saw so many self-represented litigants not finishing their divorce, and in fact, many represented litigants from the 1980s who still their cases still hadn't been resolved, San Diego started a case management plan where they brought everybody in at the four-month point and said, how's it going? You know, can we help you? What do you need to do to finish your case? Well, 7% of the people said, you know, we're trying to reconcile. We'd just like more time. We'd like to move ahead. Fine, great. 60% said there was something else we had to do. We're, you know, 6 months. We're waiting, you know. We're sending out the wedding invitations, right? I mean, this is... And, you think about it, it's not so unreasonable. If you have a traffic ticket, you get your day in court, and you know, and you show up, and you do that. If you have a small claims action, they give you a court date, you show up, you do that. In most proceedings, the court takes the responsibility to move the case along. So there's been a great movement within the court system to sort of look at that and look at voluntary ways to encourage people to help them. And God knows, you know, if we can say, can you go to mediation? Do you want to go to counseling? Whatever. But for those people who really just want to get divorced and don't know what to do, it's really a very critical issue that we provide some assistance to them. What are some of the other issues? It certainly leads to frustration on the part of private attorneys, judicial officers, when litigants are not necessarily able to articulate their issues in a way that is appropriate legally. And they're talking about the issues that matter to them, which may or may not be things that can necessarily be legally adjudicated. Certainly takes time at clerk's offices when there are problems with paperwork and other kinds of filing issues. But, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. with assistance with paperwork and information about the law, many, many people are able to proceed with their divorce and resolve their matters without ever even having to schedule a court hearing. They can file their divorce papers and move through those stages. And with guidance and assistance, many self-represented litigants can do actually a very good job at hearings. And a growing number of judges are actually saying they sort of prefer calendars with self-represented litigants because they like talking to people directly. They feel like they are able to get unfiltered information. They can ask questions, and they can help craft orders. And they find it actually quite rewarding. So I think it's possible that we can deal with this. And the California court system has been really following the lead of the chief in terms of developing a really multifaceted approach. We're not going to be able to solve this issue with one solution. So the response really tries to address providing services at the most appropriate level possible. What can we do for the most amount of people and recognizing that not everybody is going to need to have a contested court case, but everybody's going to need to have some information, guidance, assistance in moving things ahead. So as Justice Baxter pointed out, we have developed a tremendous amount of information, we have over 4 million user sessions each year on the California Court Self-Help website. And that's a great way to provide information to people at really no or very nominal cost. Well, we're delighted. We're delighted. And we just added a new section on adoption. We keep adding to it and have added videotape, audio clips, other kinds of things, trying to sort out ways that we can really help people understand the process. We've been working a lot on simplified forms. Forms are incredibly useful to help set out the necessary elements in a pleading to make sure that people know what needs to be considered by the court and to give sort of a framework to considering them. But our form structure was really developed in the 1970s, assuming again that we had attorneys involved in these cases. And we've been spending a lot of time trying to make the language more comprehensible, not necessarily taking the statutory language, but trying to sort out what some of these terms actually mean. And I say as a lawyer, we actually now at the Judicial Council get professional help to do this. It is really complicated. And I sort of go, oh my gosh, how can I explain this concept? And thankfully, there are people who are really quite thoughtful about how to do it. And we're working a lot on those issues. Also developing forms completion programs. Things like many of you have probably seen TurboTax. There's a program developed by the San Mateo Court, and then Orange County Legal Aid has also developed another program that are really designed to ask you questions and fill in that information. So you can ask questions in a way that is more comprehensible. And if you say, I don't have kids, it doesn't ask you all the questions about children, things like that. And really working, examining those, hopefully allowing them to be e-filed with the court, so people wouldn't even necessarily have to take time off work to be able to come into the court and file those documents. So we're spending a lot of time working on those. The other piece of that I find exciting is that we are also developing, we have a program in Los Angeles where we have that kind of TurboTax thing, but we're using Justice Course students to help people. What we realize is not everybody's comfortable on a computer, but gosh darn, those college students are. And the idea that you wouldn't be doing something with using the computer is somewhat antithetical to their understanding of the world. So, you know, again, we have these fairly simple questions, and litigants come in, they meet with Justice Course students who are college students who've committed at least 300 hours to providing free assistance at self-help centers under the direction of an attorney. We have 150 of these students in Los Angeles alone, and that program has also spread now to the Bay Area. So they meet with a Justice Course student, enter all the basic kind of caption information, date of marriage with the names and ages of the kids. So then that all prints out. And the more complicated questions like, what is the date of separation? or what kind of custody arrangement do you want with those kids, is dealt with in a workshop setting where everybody has their papers in front of them, but the lawyer is kind of explaining what those concepts mean. So the vast majority of the pleading is typed, but they're able to go through and do that by hand, file the papers right away. And I think that's a wonderful use of combining technology with actual people assistance and not trying to explain some tremendously complicated concepts using small, you know, segments of information. The other key thing is self-help centers. Judicial Council has determined that self-help centers are probably the most effective way to serve self-represented litigants, and we now have self-help centers in every court in California. In fact, we have 101 different court locations with self-help centers. And in this first year of funding, we're going to be providing assistance to over 450,000 people in the self-help centers under the direction of an attorney. All of them provide assistance with family law, helping them explain how to fill out forms, providing workshops, explaining the process, and also being the voice to help the court understand the issues that are being brought up by the litigants. Encouraging alternative dispute resolution. We have mandatory mediation for custody visitation issues in California, but also trying to come up with ways to help people resolve their issues through assistance, other assistance at the courthouse. Providing education to court clerks on the difference between legal information and legal advice and how they can actually help people who come to the counter and provide a helpful experience for them. Education for judges, and I think Justice Elon's going to talk a little bit more, but we've developed a bench guide for judges on how to handle cases involving self-represented litigants with information on ethics, communication skills, courtroom management, alternative dispute resolution, dealing with unintended bias, a whole variety of topics, and have developed that also as a national curriculum. And are also doing research on judicial communication to find out what self-represented litigants understand of the process and how they're perceiving the court process and how we can help them, how judges can and communicate as effectively as possible. We talked about some of the case flow management, language access. 40% of the people in California speak a language other than English at home. It is really, they may be able to get by at their job or going shopping, but the legal language in the courtroom is quite difficult. So we are really working on trying to increase the number of interpreters available in family law, and we provide grant funding for domestic violence and other family law interpretation. We need to encourage attorneys, encouraging unbundling that Sue's going to talk about, pro bono, legal aid funding. Elkins is certainly going to be working on trying to figure out ways to encourage more attorneys to practice in this area. And also looking at civil get-in as another solution to this. Reviewing court rules and processes. One of the things we found is that one of the most difficult things for people is actually just complying with the court processes. You know, the law is not quite as complicated in some situations. So to the extent that we can look at that and make it as comprehensible and possibly cutting out some of the steps, we not only make it easier for the self-represented litigant, we make it easier for the lawyer. And hopefully cut down on the fees associated with that. And then just sort of a general systemic review. We have tools for people to walk through their courthouse as if they were in it for the first time, as if they were a self-represented litigant, and see if they can find where the clerk's office is and how to file papers and things like that. And what we found is that for court personnel, it's incredibly helpful to look at the courthouse with fresh eyes and to think about how things actually work or could work better. And things like our case management system, making sure self-represented litigants can understand the information in it, making sure that they can do e-filing and other kinds of things. So trying to incorporate in all levels of court management the idea that self-represented litigants are really the majority of the litigants in family law matters, and that we really need to shift our focus to make sure that that significant group of court customers is considered and adequately served.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. We'll save up the questions until we complete the presentations. The Elkins case, as you are all aware, those of you who have been exposed to the case, really brought into focus tension between a court's obligation and responsibility to control proceedings and to create an efficient forum, and on the other hand, providing unrepresented litigants or even represented litigants and a full opportunity to present their case. It did disclose that there was a great deal of disparity from county to county in terms of court rules, et cetera. The result is that as a result of that case and the suggestion that was in the opinion, the Judicial Council is now focused on that particular issue, and the Chief Justice has appointed a task force chaired by Justice Lori Zelon to address the matter. And we have Justice Zelon with us here today, so we'll hear directly from her exactly what the task force has done. In the way of introduction, Justice Zelon serves as an Associate Justice of the California Court of Appeal in Los Angeles. And as I said, she chairs the Elkins Family Law Task Force. She received her BA degree in 1974 from Cornell University with distinction, and her JD degree in 1977 from Harvard Law School. She was admitted to the bar in 1977. She joined Morrison & Foerster as a partner in 1991, where prior to her appointment to the Superior Court in 2000, she had an active litigation practice involving scientific and technical issues, fiduciary obligations, and other complex commercial disputes. Prior to joining Morrison, she was a partner in Hustedler, Kaus, and Ettinger. Justice Zelon is a past president of the Los Angeles County Bar Association and is the recipient of many awards for her commitment to access to justice. All right.
Thank you, Justice Baxter. I want to do two things in the time I have, and so if I talk a little fast, you'll forgive me. The reason I went to Cornell was I was in New York, so I learned to talk like a New Yorker. Elkins was a pro per case. The petitioner, Jeffrey Elkins, was representing himself, and he came to court thinking, as many people do who have not been exposed to the system, that you get to court and you get to tell the judge what you're there for, and you actually get to provide testimony and tell your story. Much to his surprise, when he got to court, there was a court rule in place, a court rule which had ironically been adopted in an attempt to assist self-represented litigants in understanding the proceedings, that basically would have required him to provide all of his testimony in advance. It's a little more complicated than that, but for these purposes, that's good enough. He hadn't done that, and so his exhibits were excluded. He was not allowed to present oral testimony, and ultimately he was defaulted. And the case went up to the California Supreme Court on the question of whether how do we resolve that tension between rules intended to simplify or streamline the process and the rights of parties to due process. The court's opinion is really quite revealing on what it is that we ought to be doing. I want to tell you several things the court said. First, the court said that a procedure is efficient and moves cases through the system is admirable, but even more important is that the courts provide fair and accessible justice. The court expressed concern about the effect the rule might have in diminishing litigants' respect for and trust in the legal system. A survey done in Contra Costa County, and indeed confirmed by other studies elsewhere, confirmed that the litigants believe that their right to a day in court means that they have a right to tell their story. And when they are not allowed to tell their story, they are both frustrated and lose faith and confidence in our system of justice. And that's a critical problem for all of us. People are stunned and shocked when they find out they can't do that. Our own trust and confidence survey confirms that finding. The second thing, or one of the other things the court looked at, was how do we resolve this tension? We have this huge number of family law cases, and how do we streamline the process in a way that will work? But the court said we can't subject those litigants to second-class status, we cannot deprive them of access to justice, and we cannot deprive them of due process, because the stakes involve our children, all of the assets that people have developed over their lifetime, how they will go forward in relationships with each other and with other people in society. And these are important matters. Indeed, for many people in California, there are only two situations in which they'll see the inside of a family, of a court, other than as a juror. One is a traffic ticket, and the other is family law. And so for us not to provide resources and procedures that make sense to people in family law is really a critical problem in our system. The result was the decision of the court saying that the rules that had been developed could not stand, but also that this task force be established to look at the issues and to make sure that the rules and practices that are followed in our family law courts are easy for people to understand, economical to comply with, and most importantly, ensure that the litigant have an opportunity to present his or her case to the court. So that was the genesis of the Elkins Task Force. The task force was appointed in May of 2008. It was a very long process. There were more applicants to serve on that task force than have ever applied for a Judicial Council task force in history. And so the staff people who had the task of sorting those applications and presenting them for the appointing authorities had a very big task in front of them. The members who were chosen for the task force, and there are 38 members of the task force, it's a very large task force, were chosen both for their expertise in the family law area and to ensure that there was a balance of viewpoints. The members of the task force have several significant things in common. Most of all, they are committed to the process and they are committed to the fairness that must be the outcome of the process. Secondly, they have significant experience as practitioners or judges or administrators in the area of family law. There is one caveat. I am the blank slate of the task force in terms of family law. I tried one family law case as a lawyer and none as a judge. I have a truly open mind as to the things that come before us on the task force, and everyone else has the substantive expertise, which is very significant. We viewed our charge as to conduct a comprehensive review of family law proceedings in California, and then to use that to make recommendations to the Judicial Council, which are designed to, first, ensure due process, and second, provide effective and consistent rules, policies, and procedures throughout the state for family law. As a task force, we had a lot of discussion about how we had to go about this process and what our output had to be. We believe as a task force that to achieve meaningful change in family law, we must be collaborative in our process, we must have patient listening, and inclusivity. And we have to seriously examine the procedures and not just rely on things that have been done because they have been done in the past. We defined our values for our work to ensure justice, fairness, and due process, to ensure meaningful access to justice for all litigants, to use innovative techniques to promote effectiveness and efficiency, to improve the status of and respect for family law litigants and for the family law process. And that, I think, is something that you heard in what Bonnie said about assignments and stress. And finally, to secure adequate resources, which in these budgetary times must include the reallocation of existing resources where necessary and attempts to make changes that do not require an immediate infusion of new resources, since that is going to be a little bit difficult to get. We anticipate completing our work over the next 2 years. We have four initial working groups which focus on research and best practices, representation issues, process improvements, and improving the status of family law. We are trying to get input from every stakeholder we can find to do our work. Litigants, attorneys, judicial officers, and court staff. We are conducting focus groups across the state of California. We are conducting focused research on promising practices within California jurisdictions, within jurisdictions outside of California, including international jurisdictions. It turns out that Australia and New Zealand have been doing very innovative things for a number of years, and we're beginning to look at those processes to see what will work here. Our task force members have been charged to go out across the state to speak at every panel they can, to solicit input, and to let people know what we are doing so that they will know what to anticipate from the process. Once we begin to get closer to recommendations, we will have public hearings to test out those recommendations and get reaction to them. We are doing a survey of bar members. We are seeking public comment through the web, through the email, through snail mail, through personal contacts, and any other way we can. And once we get to the point of having draft recommendations, we will circulate them widely for comment. I do want to footnote this with a point. Elkins stemmed from a self-represented litigant, and a lot of what Bonnie obviously spoke about were the problems faced by self-represented litigants. But there are serious issues in the family law processes that affect people who are there with counsel as well. And the task force feels that we need to address those very seriously. The processes can be more of a barrier than the law, as Bonnie said, but that is true for represented litigants as well as the self-represented. When we don't have enough resources in the family law courts to schedule proceedings so that they can be started and completed in a sequential way rather than over a period of months in short pieces, that's not only a burden for the self-represented, it's a huge burden for those who have to pay their lawyers to redo and redo and redo. It's difficult scheduling for lawyers who must come to court repeatedly on the same issue and must wait months and months for resolution. And that kind of significant drain makes it more difficult for everyone in family law court and makes it more difficult for people to stay represented, even if they are represented at the outset of the proceedings. So any changes that we seek to recommend will be considered first in light of their impact on the party, regardless of their representation status. Is this going to impede or help people to get their cases resolved in family law courts? And then as a secondary consideration, we will review that to see if the status of the person, their representation status requires any adjustment in the procedures. But we do believe firmly that simplification and clarity in the long run will benefit everyone who uses the family law courts in California. I want to shift for just a minute to some of the initiatives for self-represented litigants. Bonnie spoke about some of them. Much of what has happened came out of the Judicial Council Task Force on Self-Represented Litigants, which is chaired by Justice O'Leary from the 4th District, and which I am proud to be a member of. It was established in 2004, but was preceded by a working group appointed in 2001. So we've been at this for a long time, and adopted an action plan, which has been implemented in large part in 2004. We have used pilot projects looking at different geographic areas, county size, jurisdiction size, the kinds of litigants in the area, that is the language problems, the poverty problems, and other issues affecting people's abilities, and have made recommendations in three areas. A court rule, guidelines for self-help centers, and judicial education. In terms of the self-help centers, as Bonnie pointed out, there is funding now to establish those centers in every county. In July of this year, a new rule of court was adopted. It's rule 10.960. And the most important part of that rule is, in my view, the fact that providing access to justice for self-represented litigants is not only defined as a priority for California courts, but it is defined as a core function of the California courts. That really puts us in the position of recognizing our obligation as a court system to the people who use our court, and it's a significant step forward. Pursuant to that court rule, the task force was tasked with recommending guidelines for operations of self-help centers, which were recommended to the council and were issued as of March 1st of this year. They will be updated every 3 years. As there is significant new learning and experience in this area, the guidelines which help courts establish their self-help centers and keep them running in the most appropriate way will be adapted as we have new information and as we become more sophisticated in what we're doing. And so that's a very important process. Bonnie has mentioned the bench book. The curriculum which people in California, Bonnie, chief among them, was very instrumental in developing, is a curriculum that helps judges understand how to deal with self-represented litigants. It is a sea change for us. The Chief Justice of New Hampshire is very interested in this process, and he is prone to giving speeches which say, our courts are not our grandmother's courts anymore. And by that he means that we started out as a system where people came in with lawyers, and the lawyers told the judges what they needed to know, and they did it in a way that made sense, and we don't have that anymore. And we have huge numbers of people who, if we can't give the judges tools to help them rationally respond to the needs of those people, judges will become very frustrated. He is very concerned that if the courts across the country as a whole do not do something, in 20 years it will be almost impossible to get the caliber of people that we want to serve on our courts to continue to serve on our courts, because they will be frustrated and without tools to provide access to justice. So the curriculum is designed to give judges those tools. It was first tried out at a conference at Harvard in just about a year ago. Teams came from, I think, 42 states and jurisdictions and took the materials home and began to teach their own judges. We followed it up in September of this year with a conference in Baltimore for court administrators. And they are very interested in what they can do to help their judges deal with the issues that are presented. State-by-state teaching is ongoing. Many of the people involved in the curriculum are going from state to state teaching judges. And it's a fascinating experience to take judges out of their comfort zone and then give them tools to make that part of their comfort zone. Here in California, CJUR has been very involved in the process and has training for new judicial officers and at family law trainings, and indeed is expanding that training elsewhere. So we are taking steps forward. It is a very long road and a complicated road, but I have some confidence that we are on the right track, and that with your assistance and your input, the Elkins Task Force will be able to make recommendations that help us ensure due process. Thank you.
Justice Zeland's comment about providing judges with adequate training and background information to do the job brings into mind a situation that I experienced where a very highly qualified civil litigator was appointed to a court in a county that I won't identify. And the bar was just really pleased with the appointment. Of course, he was immediately assigned to family law, and he had never handled family law matters before. His first case was a child custody dispute, and a week later I received his resignation. So that's an example of what I referred to earlier. Our next panelist comes from the private sector. Sue Telia is a certified family law specialist based in Danville. And after 20 years in complex family law litigation, she limited her practice in 1998 to private judging of family law cases. She is a nationally recognized expert on limited scope representation and the chair of the Limited Representation Committee of the California Commission on Access to Justice, a member of the California State Bar Standing Committee on the Delivery of Legal Services, and numerous other organizations dedicated to improving access to justice by developing creative delivery models for legal assistance. She is the author of two books, one entitled How to Avoid the Divorce from Hell and Dance Together at Your Daughter's Wedding, and the second, Unbundling Your Divorce, How to Find a Lawyer to Help You Help Yourself. She also has just published a new ebook entitled Everything I Needed to Know I Learned After Law School. Sue?
Thank you, Justice Baxter. I am delighted to see so many people staying around at this late hour for this very important topic. I concur with Bonnie's and Lori's comments that the issues relating to family law go to the very heart of our society and our ability to protect our most vulnerable citizens. So thank you. I know this has been a long day, and I do appreciate it. I appreciate also Bonnie putting this in statistical perspective, because when you think about the sheer numbers, it is compelling. If 70% of family law litigants in the state of California do not have a lawyer, that means that 100% of the family lawyers in this state represent less than a third of its citizens. That is a stunning statistic. And so we have to look at that and see, what do we do to meet the legal needs of these people? Similarly, you know, regardless of what you think about the current state of the economy, I can assure you that 70% of the population of the state of California is not poor. I mean, they're poorer than they were a month ago. But we're not just talking about poor people. We're talking about middle class, and this is very much a middle class-driven issue. The average divorcing couple who maybe has a house, two cars, and a pension cannot afford to hire two full-service family lawyers to do it in the traditional way. So what does limited scope representation mean? I prefer the term limited scope representation to unbundling, just because I think it's a better description of what it is. It is a relationship between an attorney and a client where they agree that the attorney will perform some of the tasks, services contained within traditional full-service representation, but not all. Now, when we look at the statistics, the other thing that statistics makes very clear is that the only way to meet the needs, realistically, of these vast numbers of people is to engage the private bar, along with simplified court procedures, self-help centers, this whole continuum of services, improved funding to legal aid so that they can actually go back to helping divorcing parties. And in order to engage the private bar, which is my particular focus, I became very, very interested in limited scope representation. I've been teaching it since 1996. I've taught thousands of lawyers in California and around the country how to do limited scope representation ethically, safely, and in the private sector, actually profitably. The other aspect of limited scope representation, which I need to underscore, though, is it's not just private practitioners representing clients for certain tasks or a certain piece of a case. It also is critically important to the increased use of pro bono. Pro bono recruiters are my best friends, because I come in, I teach people how to do a piece of a case or a lawyer for a day, and they can then increase the number of lawyers who will volunteer for a pro bono case. And it's not surprising that there are a lot of lawyers who are kind of reluctant to volunteer for a pro bono divorce case. I mean, if there's a two-year-old child, they may be, and a custody dispute, they may be signing on for 16 years of custody litigation, or at least that's their fear. So it's very important in terms of increasing the proper use of limited resources, increasing pro bono, setting up clinics and lawyer for the day programs. So it's not just private practitioners, but and clinics are can be incredibly helpful. They're as brilliant as the Family Law Facilitator Program, which Bonnie set up, has been in this state. There are still people who need more personalized, more specialized help. There are people who need more than a self-help center, but their needs can be met by a clinic where you're sitting around and people are working on their papers together. But there are still people who need more help than that. They need more personalized advice. Even with the best coaching in the world, they can't prepare competent pleadings. And for those people, there are people who will always need full-service representation. So I always tell people this isn't for every case, it isn't for every issue, it isn't for every court. But where it is appropriate, and many, many family law issues are extremely appropriate for this. For one thing, family law courts are much more user-friendly than most other courts. They've had to be, and they were becoming more so as the Elkins Task Force does its work. And so there are millions of people who have middle-class people, working poor, they have assets to protect, they need help negotiating the system, and they can afford to buy an hour or two of a lawyer's time, or they can afford to pay somebody to draft their documents so that they can actually frame the issues in a way that the judge can understand and provide appropriate relief. So what I want people to come away from this is that this is one piece of a number of pieces which all have to come together in order to meet the needs of the currently unrepresented family law population. This has been developing, it started developing kind of grassroots. Fortunately, we are so fortunate in this state that we have a proactive and very access-conscious judicial counsel, administrative office of the courts, the judicial counsel and AOC early in the 2000s really took this on as an issue and encouraged and actually provided grant money for counties and bar associations and legal aid groups who were willing to take on this issue, sponsor trainings, and get it out there in the grassroots to the lawyers who really need to have this kind of training. Rule 5.70 and 5.71 were adopted in July of 2003, which specifically define and encourage limited scope representation. A companion set of civil rules, 3.35 et sec, went into effect January 1, I think it's 07. Yeah, 07. So what does this mean? Well, limited scope representation has to be tailored to individual cases, individual issues. It takes many different forms. And so you can think of it as kind of a continuum of services. On the most benign, you've got advice and counsel. A client comes in, they have a presenting problem, they consult with the attorney, they find out what their rights and responsibilities are, and they go away. The vast majority of limited scope representation arrangements involve more than advice and counsel, less than appearing in court. By far, that's the vast majority. It's document assistance. It is coaching on procedures. It's assisting with settlement negotiations with the other side, organizing documents, organizing information, exhibits, whatever falls just short of appearing in court. And then in a small number, but growing number of cases, it actually may require that an attorney appears in court for a single hearing, sometimes, that's very common, a single issue. This happens all the time in family law. A family doesn't have a whole lot of property and their support issues are relatively simple and that can all be done with a self-help center. But somebody's got a pension issue. There has to be a qualified domestic relations order. That's very technical. Most family lawyers farm that out to specialists. So that's a classic example of where a client would hire an attorney for just one issue. Or you've got there's not much property, not much support. You've got, the custody case from hell, and somebody needs to have that supervised visitation order or the drug testing or the ankle bracelet or whatever orders they need to get, and it's too technical for them to do by themselves. And so we are seeing more and more of those situations in court. There are now mandatory court forms where people appear in court. If you're appearing, FL 950 in family law and MC 950 for civil law puts both the court and opposing party / counsel on notice as to where the limitation on scope is. Now, the key to an effective limited scope arrangement is that there is a bright line box drawn around what the attorney is going to do. And that is tailored to the case, discussed with the client. And the key is that the attorney doesn't step outside that bright line box, because then it creates all sorts of problems. The ethical rules, we find that there are four basic ethical rules. They're pretty much no-brainers when you stop and think about them. An attorney, a limited scope representation has to be reasonable under the circumstances. Well, yes. It has to be informed and in writing. Yes, the client needs to know they're getting limited scope, the bright line box, and not soup to nuts. Changes in scope have to be memorialized. Comes up all the time. Somebody sees an attorney in family law on a child support issue, and next thing you know, they're defending a move away. So it has to be flexible so that a new box is drawn as new issues pop up. And the rule from the only real malpractice case in California on this issue, Nichols v. Keller, says that an attorney has an obligation to advise a client on related issues even if not asked. Again, I think that's a no-brainer. When I started teaching this, people would say, oh, Nichols v. Keller, the sky is going to fall, and Nichols v. Keller says you can't do it. And I would say, have you read Nichols v. Keller? Because that's not what it says. What it says is, client consults on this issue within the box, and I, lawyer, know that there's a potential claim outside the box that's outside my expertise, but I know it exists. I have an obligation to tell that client, you know what, this isn't my expertise, but you need to consult with someone on that related third-party claim, or you need to consider that if you go in for a change in modification of your timeshare, this is likely going to trigger a change in your support. Not hard to do, but these are relatively simple rules. The issues come up in the nuances, of course, and in practice. And what I tell people is these are rules that are relatively simple. They're common sense. They are absolutely immutable. There are no exceptions. There are simply no exceptions. And so, but when done correctly, and we've actually, there was a task force through the Access to Justice Commission, which put together, which Justice Zeline chaired, which put together a set of risk management materials, which is what I teach from. The family law risk management materials were approved in 2004. Civil materials came out last year. These include sample fee agreements, client handouts, office checklists, anything anybody needs to do to know or to have in their office to practice this very safely, effectively, and ethically. And I always tell people when I teach, and this is available on the Judicial Council website as well for download for free, if you do it this way, you have to work really, really hard to mess it up. Really hard. So it's important to follow the rules, but this is a critical component of trying to meet the vast need that our families in this state are suffering right now. If half of the population in a state cannot have access to meaningful legal advice on something as important as their child, their property, their personal safety, then something is wrong with the delivery system. And so the good news is that in the state of California, many, many people are working on aspects of improving the delivery system. And I want to say I thank you particularly to Justice George, whose personal support and advocacy has been so instrumental in getting Bar Association buyout, you know, the buy-in. The Bar Associations are afraid this is going to take away their clients, and I have to point out to them, no, these are nobody's clients. Remember, these are the 70% that nobody represents. Nobody wants these right now. I'm going to show you how you can bring them in and actually make a little bit of money representing them. It has been so helpful to, as I travel around, to follow somebody who has heard Justice George speak about the importance of this. It's important to have support from the bench, from the trial bench. Most judges in high-volume courts love this because they get pleadings they can understand. Instead of 18 years worth of he done me wrong, you actually get something that is framed in terms of legal rights and facts and responsibilities. In the future, I don't see this problem going away. I am sincerely hopeful that all of the efforts that all of us on this panel are doing are going to change the system, make it much more user-friendly, make it in such a way that families can with confidence go into court, which as Bonnie points out is the only place you can get a divorce, and know that they have reasonable vehicles to put their story before the judge, know that the judge has time and resources to deal with their situation appropriately, and they're going to get a fair and impartial hearing. And this is one piece, but all of these pieces really have to come together for the good of the citizens of the state of California. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Our commentator is a highly respected voice on a wide range of topics related to equality. Professor Banks focuses his scholarship on the use of race in public policy debates, ranging from the adoption of children to the use of educational testing criteria in college admissions. Before attending law school, Professor Banks was an extensively published freelance journalist, writing articles for the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, among others. Before joining the Stanford Law School faculty in 1998, Professor Banks was the Reginald F. Lewis Fellow at Harvard Law School and attorney with the firm of O'Melveny & Myers. He was a law clerk to Judge Barrington D. Parker, Jr. of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. Professor Banks received his B.A. degree in 1987 from Stanford University, his M.A. in 1987 from Stanford University, and his J.D. degree in 1994 from Harvard Law School. Professor?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. My primary goal as the last speaker on the last panel of the day is to make sure that we all, that we end on time. This is a great pleasure to be here. I made the drive across the bay. I didn't expect, though, that I would be confronted with this when I arrived. I thought this would be friendlier territory, but I'll put that aside. Because the reason we're here is to talk about what is clearly the most important interaction that most people will have in their lives with the judicial system. And that is when they need a divorce or need to resolve a child custody matter or some other matter related to their family and children. So it is a great thing that we're all here. As I hear the panelists, and this is inspiring to hear how much is going on, but I keep going back to the case, back to the Elkins case, and thinking, you know, if I were talking to a class, my first question to them would be, you know, what's the problem here? And someone would probably say, well, the problem is that there's a local rule that conflicts with the statutory procedural rule, and so the statewide statute has to prevail. The local rule is invalid. They need to rewrite the local rule. And then they'd probably get a question like, well, how do we know that the local rule is a bad rule and not that the statewide procedural rule should just have some sort of exception for this circumstance? And then we'd probably begin to talk about what really bothers us about the case. And what might bother us is a sense of unfairness in the outcome of the case. After all, this was a case where we're told at the end of the day, Mr. Elkins essentially lost a lot of what he might have gained had the rules been otherwise, that the order signed by the court was essentially consistent with the order proposed by the wife's counsel, and Elkins being unrepresented by counsel, Mr. Elkins being unrepresented by counsel, lost out in this process. So there was something unfair about that. And that unfairness, in turn, as the opinion notes, can breed a distrust in the legal system, a sense that it just doesn't work the way it should. Now, everyone would agree, and I think everyone in here would agree, that trust in the legal system is important. That fairness to litigants is important. But, of course, there might be more than one way to accomplish those goals. And in listening to the discussion of innovations and initiatives here, I'm struck by the two competing impulses that seem to play out or seem to be present in this conversation. On the one hand, we think of law as getting your day in court. I mean, that's certainly language that was prominent in the opinion, is prominent in the way we think about law What it means to have a legal system is that you can get your day in court. You tell your story to the judge, they listen, they make a decision, and that's justice. This is our adversarial system at work. On the other hand, of course, we know that in family law in particular, we might think it not such a good thing for judges to make many of these decisions. We might, in fact, want the litigants, or the parties, rather, even before they become litigants, the parties to make these decisions and to decide among themselves what should happen to their property, what should happen to their children, how they should reorganize their lives in light of the new relationship they will have post-dissolution. Now, these are two different models of how we should decide family law matters, divorce matters in particular. One is adversarial, day in court, judge decides. The other we might call more consensual, private resolution. We want to encourage the parties to decide. So as we're in class, of course, the student will say, well, you know, but we can have both of those, right? I mean, we can encourage people to resolve disputes on their own, but then we have the judicial process for those who don't resolve disputes. And that's true, right? I mean, we, in fact, have to have the judicial process, and we want that process to run as smoothly as possible, because not everyone will resolve their dispute on their own. But at the same time, there is a tension between the two, or at least a trade-off between the two. We might imagine that the more appealing we make the judicial process, the less appealing we make private resolution. Right? We could think of it as in terms of cost, right? The greater the cost of going to court, the more people might want to not go to court, and the greater their incentives might be to resolve these disputes on their own. This was vividly brought home to me by an acquaintance who had a divorce, and they were in court. This was in California, and they went before the judge, and he wanted his day in court. And the judge told them both quite forthrightly, if you don't resolve this on your own, then ultimately I'll make the decision. And you don't want me making the decision. And he and his wife, at some point, they realized that that had to be right. They didn't want the judge making the decision, right? Even if you put aside the money that they'd have to spend to get to the point of the judge making the decision, that wasn't what was best for them. And they eventually got together and they worked it out. So there are these two possibilities. My own view, I'll be forthright, is that there's a lot to be said for private resolution. And a lot to be said for parties working out the procedures, or rather working out their conflicts with less judicial involvement rather than more. But the question I have for the panelists goes to how do we balance these two possibilities or these two alternative ways of thinking about this issue. Many of the initiatives that we've heard, limited scope counsel, other initiatives seem to be very adversarially related, right? The focus is on having a court system that we have accessible to people, that people can afford to get into, right? Other initiatives that we've heard, sort of the TurboTax of family law, having forms that you can fill out, questionnaires that you can answer, all of those sorts of initiatives, they seem to almost operate independent of the judge or independent of lawyers. They seem to be more self-help, more consensual rather than adversarial. So this leads me to the question, I guess my central question, is that is the problem really lack of representation here? What if we strive for a system where even a higher percentage of litigants were not represented by counsel, right?
Go ahead.
Not represented by counsel. What would be wrong with that if we felt confident that, and this is a big if we felt confident that the outcomes of this system would lead both to trust in the process, right, that people would feel good about the processes that they were a part of, and if by some metric we could determine that the resolutions were fair.
Let me deconstruct your question a little bit, because I think the system has a lot more gray in it than those two extremes. For one thing, one of the reasons people can't resolve their disputes, I mean, you could theoretically work everything out, come to court, say, Judge, we've got it all worked out, all we need is an order, and that'll be fine. The court has to be involved, but the court doesn't have to decide things. But where there is an imbalance of power between the spouses, either because one has more economic power or one has more physical power or there's violence in the relationship, then leaving the parties to work it out by themselves is not going to be a satisfactory resolution. Also, where there is a lack of knowledge, it's going to be very hard to come to a fair resolution. Most people do not know their legal rights. We don't teach that well in school. And so if people don't know that they have a right to share in their former spouse's pension, for example, they can work out something which would be fundamentally unfair and which would be a bad societal result, because people will have to depend more on society for needs that could have been met by their former spouse. And so I think it is not just an on-off switch in this, but we have to consider those imbalances and those areas of lack of knowledge.
I think Sue might back me up on this. Oftentimes, I would have clients who really weren't interested in a fair hearing in court. They really wanted the other spouse's hide. They were emotionally involved in the case, and you know, they wanted to fight it out, and I can tell you that in the family law area, your worst nightmare is to go up against a lawyer who doesn't have any experience and who ends up being the client's mouthpiece and does exactly what the client tells him to do, as opposed to a more experienced lawyer that will explain to the client that the emotional issues have no bearing on this, on the outcome, and I'm the lawyer and I'm going to call the shots, and if you don't like the representation you're getting, go to somebody else. So that's an area where I think representation can be extremely helpful, not only to the clients but also to the court, to avoid unnecessary hearings that where the outcome is obvious.
And I would support that. That's absolutely true. The other comment that I would make is family law is technically complicated. I mean, it's not just pots and pans, folks. We've got serious entitlements, serious responsibilities, fiduciary. Tell me another kind of litigation where the litigants are in fiduciary relationship to each other until the last scrap of property is divided. This isn't some arm's-length traffic accident. Litigants are trying to function in an adversarial system which was designed for people who are at arm's length and represented, and not only are they not at arm's length, they owe each other fiduciary duties, and they can't afford a lawyer to explain to them what they're supposed to be doing. So this really is a very, very complicated area of the law. And I'm all for settlement, but, you know, it's not that simple.
Yeah, and I think that there are plenty of people who can absolutely resolve their issues without going to court, and many of them do, thankfully, because if not, the whole system would grind to a halt. I think the difficulty is trying, again, having the sort of nuanced approach. I mean, for example, I was watching in one court where the people came in on a child support issue. It was pretty clear that they had a lot of, you know, disagreement and stuff and had not had a lot of information or preparation. And the judge referred them to the family law facilitator to help them with a mediation beforehand, just said, you know, I'm going to continue your case and, you know, see, you can come back later this morning. They met with a facilitator who was able to explain how the law worked, got the basic agreement, okay, this is how much dad makes, this is how much mom makes. They continued to have a disagreement because mom said he has always worked overtime and dad said, oh gosh, not since our separation, you know, it's not no longer available. Not an uncommon kind of problem. So the facilitator was able to then just print out two different support calculations saying, okay, based on your situation, this is what, you know, here's with overtime, here's without. And then they were able to go into court and just discuss that one issue. So all the other issues were taken care of. And I think that's another service that we need to be able to try and provide to the litigants to help them work those things out.
Okay, well, great. So now, what? So let's look at it from the other side. Are there any, being a lawyer, are there any downsides, I wonder, though, to having, if we could have universal representation, right? We solve the no representation problem. We have universal representation. Put aside how we're going to pay for it. Any downsides to that system?
It's hard to say that people shouldn't have competent legal advice on any legal problem they have.
Wow. Okay.
As a lawyer, I have a hard time defending that.
Okay, well, let me just say, I mean, I come to this as an outsider to the, I'm not in the courthouse, in the nitty-gritty, and when I started teaching law, I began to focus a lot more on lawyers, and I mean, felt that, well, lawyers were solutions to problems. Almost always, whatever the problem was, the answer was to have a good lawyer involved, and that's still often the case, I think. But I guess over time, I've come to wonder whether in some cases we don't need, you know, less law, less lawyering. We might imagine that the lawyer's incentives are not always the same as the incentives or the interests of the parties, that they're not perfectly aligned. There's some sort of what we might call an agency principle problem. We might imagine that these problems are especially are exacerbated in the family law context because of the circumstances of the parties. We might imagine that that lawyers, there might be some negative consequences that might come from lots of lawyering as well. And I can see this is going to be met skeptically here. I'll just throw that out. I mean, is this just the myopia of a professor that there might be some cases where we want to design the system so that people need less lawyering, right? And so we want more self-help, we want more forms, we want more questionnaires, we want more education. We want to do more as a state so that people can navigate the system and need less help rather than more help to do so. Is that sensible?
Yeah, but I think there are at least two answers to that. One is you're postulating physics world, that is that place in which we all learn physics where there is no friction and there is no gravity. And we can assume that things move smoothly across the plane. And we're not in that world. The starting point that money is no object really assumes away a great many things, not just the social cost of public money going into the system, but the choices that people make with their own resources. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that people are paying for the lawyers out of their own resources, there are different questions about whether that's the best use of resources or whether more money should be put away for kids' college education.
Well, I mean, say, right. So that actually bolsters my, I mean, that sharpens the point, though, right? The fact that people are actually depleting what, you know, 50-70% of the estate through paying attorney's fees, right? Which has to happen a lot. And it would happen even more if everyone were represented by a lawyer. We would have people who were paying 50% of their estate for attorneys. And so the question is, do we think that that's a good system to set it up where those are the choices? And especially in light of the power disparities issue, which is another issue I was going to raise. It's, you know, so what happens there is that another reason you feel for Stanley Elkins is that, you know, he doesn't have a lawyer, his wife does have a lawyer, tremendous power imbalance there, right? So if we set up a system where we are strongly urging everyone to have a lawyer. Any litigant who thinks of going it alone is making a foolish decision, right? They're making a foolish decision if they're going to go it alone when their spouse has a lawyer, if the system is set up to advantage those who have counsel rather than those who don't. So the fact that people pay for the fees out of their own pocket sort of heightens the issue of, you know, maybe we should have a system where there's less need to have counsel.
Well, I think that's a different question than should you have lawyers or not. The question is, can we design a system that works in a way that is more accessible, that is, people can understand it better, they can understand what they need to do, and can provide for the resolution of disputes without things requiring so much complication from lawyers. So I guess I would look at it from the system side rather than the lawyer side.
Now we're going to take some questions, and then we'll start to really mix it up here.
I think this question might go to Sue. If you'd care to comment on collaborative practice, divorce, perhaps that may parallel what Professor Banks has just expressed.
Sure. Collaborative practice is growing in family law, in popularity. And in collaborative practice, there are, as with everything else, advantages and disadvantages. In collaborative practice, the attorneys and the parties agree that they are not going to litigate. That's an agreement they reach at the beginning of the case. They agree that they are going to negotiate as long as it takes. They'll bring, if there are expert witnesses, they'll bring their experts in, and they will continue working until they have a resolution. And if one side decides to back out of the deal, the attorney agrees that they're going to withdraw. So there is there's a downside for walking away from a collaborative practice and saying, fine, I've been negotiating long enough, I want to go fight, because they then have to bring another lawyer up to speed. And that's part of the deterrent for walking out of the process. That can work beautifully. It can also result in endless negotiation, because without the deadline of, if we don't solve this, tomorrow morning the judge is going to say, call your first witness, counsel. I've seen these things go on for years, and if somebody just throws up their hands and says, I can't deal with this anymore, because there's no incentive for the other side to make any concessions. So in the right kind of case, it's great as long as everybody is on the same page, and it can be abused.
Can mediation be invoked in family law proceedings, and how does that
compare? Huge. Mediation is huge in family law. And in mediation, the parties may or may not have consulting attorneys, but they will meet with a trained mediator, a lawyer who is required to have training in mediation, with the goal of working out their own agreement. It's generally about a third of the time. It takes about a third of the time as a garden variety divorce case. Significantly, probably a third or less of the cost, probably consider significantly less than a third of the cost. It allows people with a skilled mediator to craft their decision. There's an individual who's moving the process along. Most mediators will say, I want you each to have consulting counsel because I can't advise you. I'm your mediator. I'm not representing either of you. So I want you to at least have somebody that you're consulting about these agreements we're talking about entering into so that you understand the legal consequences of what you're agreeing to. It's interesting because with the financial down, I'm not a mediator myself, but my partner is, and with the financial downturn, the mediators I'm talking to, not just my partner, but people across the board, are saying their mediation cases are going up and their litigation cases are going down just because of the economic realities.
Well, we do have one question from the audience. I think it goes like this, that if you're going to be a bankruptcy judge, you should be a bankruptcy lawyer. So if you're going to be a family law judge, why shouldn't you be a family law lawyer first? What do you think?
Please, God. Please, God. Family law is complicated, and as a family lawyer for over 30 years, I know the frustration of going into court and realizing that the case that I've just prepared on a very complicated family law issue is going to go to somebody who was in the district attorney's office last week and has and doesn't know a Schedule C from vitamin C. And it's very frustrating. It's frustrating for the litigants. It's frustrating for the judges. And so I would absolutely support and, in fact, have in the past lobbied for the appointment of family lawyers, family law specialists who will commit to stay in the family law assignment.
And one last question. Is there any effort on pre-marriage counseling to keep people married instead of divorced? Are you aware of anything in that area?
I am aware of some. The interesting wrinkle where I thought you were going to go with that is I have seen any number of cases where people go into mediation to mediate their prenuptial agreement. And there's been more than one marriage that didn't take place as a result of flushing out all the... Because what it does is it flushes out all of the unspoken assumptions. If we get married, I'm assuming that you're going to do this, and I'm assuming that I'm going to do that. And when you get them into mediation and they realize, well, boy, that's not the way I think this is supposed to come down.
It is a good thing.
It saves a divorce later.
Professor Banks has
one more question. This is this is on the less law theme again, or less judicial activity theme. So if you're you're a same-sex couple, you enter a domestic partnership, and you decide you want to dissolve that domestic partnership. You can do that pretty simply.
All the same procedures.
But if you can, in certain circumstances, you can file a notice without...
If you're in a domestic partnership for less than 5 years, mm-hmm. and you have minimal assets and no kids, mm-hmm. you can file through the Secretary of State. It's like our mm-hmm. summary dissolution procedure, mm-hmm. and they model it on theirs. Other than that, you are entitled to and have the opportunity to go through the exact same procedures. Okay. And it's even more complicated because of the federal laws and taxes and all kinds of things. It doesn't have to be that way. I'm just saying that is the way it is right now.
Okay.
Let's give our panelists a round of applause.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.